them to keep them always in a state of servitude, and not allow them to become again one of the masters. The consent of the governed is the hallmark of a constitutional republic. Yet it seems the American people have lost faith in Congress as an institution. Congress, which is supposed to reflect the will of the people better than the other branches of the federal government, is consistently rated very poorly by the citizenry. The level of public disenchantment is significant. Congress's approval averaged 14% for the first part of 2013, 15% in 2012, 17% in 2011, and 19% in 2010. The longevity of incumbency has created a class of professional politicians who operate at an increasing distance from their constituents. Term limits and the more frequent rotation of individuals in and out of Congress provide a remedy consistent with the framers' intent and approach to representative government. Chapter 3. An Amendment to Restore the Senate. Section 1. The 17th Amendment is hereby repealed. All senators shall be chosen by their state legislatures as prescribed by Article 1. Section 2. This amendment shall not be so construed as to affect the term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution. Section 3. When vacancies occur in the representation of any state in the Senate for more than 90 days, the governor of the state shall appoint an individual to fill the vacancy for the remainder of the term. Section 4. A senator may be removed from office by a two-thirds vote of the state legislature. An amendment to the U.S. Constitution that was sold as a cleansing and transformative expansion of popular democracy is actually an object lesson in the malignancy of the progressive mindset and its destructive impact on the way we practice self-government in a 21st century post-constitutional nation. The amendment in question is the 17th, ratified April 8, 1913. Its language is deceptively uncomplicated. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. When vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election as the legislature may direct. This amendment shall not be construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution. The 17th Amendment altered fundamentally the way most senators had been chosen for 124 years. Prior to its ratification, United States senators were usually selected by the legislatures of the various states, two from each state. They served for 6 years, with a third of the Senate being up for state legislative re-election every 2 years. If vacancies in Senate seats arose between elections, the state legislatures typically chose a replacement to serve the remainder of the unexpired term. If a vacancy occurred at a time when a state legislature was out of session, the governor of the state was empowered to name a temporary officeholder who would serve until the legislature reconvened and could choose a new senator. Considered by itself, the 17th Amendment seemed reasonable enough, which is why it was ratified in near record time. If democracy in limited doses is good, so went the progressive cant at the time, more democracy could only be proportionally better. If choosing congressmen and congresswomen in the House of Representatives by popular vote worked so well, Then why not choose senators by direct popular elections? The fact that the framers established a different method for choosing senators and considered that method critical to the proper functioning of the federal government was of no consequence. However, the framers did in fact value democratic expression. For most of them, popular democracy was a vital aspect of consensual government. But they also understood that along with its benefits there were shortcomings, and the will of the people, subject to majoritarian and factional swings and lurches, should be balanced with dispassionate, considered judgment. The simple logical elegance of the organization of the Senate belied the extent and passion of the discussions over its creation, both at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 and in the state ratifying conventions. Like nearly every clause in the Constitution, the framers intended that the nature and operation of the Senate serve several functions simultaneously. Providing the state governments with direct input in the national government was not only an essential check on the new federal government's power, but also a means by which the states could influence congressional lawmaking without stripping the federal government of its enumerated primacy over certain matters of governance. Moreover, the equal representation in the Senate provided the less populated states with a critical limit on the possibility that the more populated states would hold powerful sway over the affairs of the nation. Moreover, the small size and relative stability of the Senate created an institutional means for tempering fleeting majoritarian or factional passions. There was also strong sentiment among the convention delegates that the Senate, by virtue of its limited size and exclusive membership, could serve as a de facto privy council for the president. At the outset of the Constitutional Convention, Virginia Governor Edmund Randolph rose to offer what would become known as the Virginia Plan for the organization of the new national government, as a point from which to begin deliberations. The plan, authored primarily by James Madison, included a bicameral national legislature, a unitary executive, and a national judiciary. The first and largest body of Congress, which would become the House of Representatives, was to be elected directly by the people. The second body, which would become the Senate, would be much smaller and chosen by the first out of candidates put forth by the state legislatures. While no specific terms of office were proposed in the Virginia Plan, it was largely understood that the members of the smaller upper house, Senate, would serve longer than their counterparts in the lower house, House of Representatives. The initial discussions on the Virginia Plan presented an interesting dichotomy of perspectives on the roles of the two houses of the national legislature. Madison, in the same breath, argued strenuously for the election of the House by the people. Mr. Madison considered the popular election of one branch of the national legislature as essential to every plan of free government, and for refining the popular appoints by successive filtrations to be resorted to only in the appointment of the second branch of the legislature and in the executive and judiciary branches of the government. Elbridge Gerry, a delegate from Massachusetts and future Vice President of the United States, did not like the election by the people. Experience had shown that the state legislatures drawn immediately from the people did not always possess their confidence. He had no objection, however, to an election by the people if it were so qualified that men of honor and character might not be unwilling to be joined in the appointments. He seemed to think the people might nominate a certain number out of which the state legislatures should be bound to choose. In the convention's first vote on the election of the larger House of Congress by the people, the vote was 6 states voting yes, 2 voting no, with 2 divided. The convention then addressed the resolution in the Virginia Plan, calling for the election by the second house of the national legislature, the Senate, by the first, the House. Richard Speight, a delegate from North Carolina, moved to amend the resolution to say that the second branch be chosen by the state legislatures. South Carolina delegate Pierce Butler apprehended that the taking so many powers out of the hands of the states, as was proposed, tended to destroy all that balance and security of interests among the states which is necessary to preserve, and called on Mr. Randolph, the mover of the propositions, to explain the extent of his ideas, and particularly the number of members he meant to assign to the second branch. Randolph stated that, while he had not had in mind a specific number, it ought to be much smaller than that of the first, so small as to be exempt from the passionate proceedings to which numerous assemblies are liable. He observed that the general object was to provide a cure for the evils under which the U.S. labored, that in tracing these evils to their origin every man had found in the turbulence and follies of democracy, that some check therefore was to be sought for against this tendency of our governments, and that a good Senate seemed most likely to answer the purpose. Similar expressions arose throughout the convention, whenever discussion of the provenance of the Senate took place. On June 7th, Delaware's John Dickinson made a notion that the second house of the national legislature, the Senate, be chosen by the state legislatures. He did so because this mode will more intimately connect the state governments with the national legislature. It will also draw forth the first characters either as to family or talent, and that it ought to consist of a considerable number. Dickinson related the upper house, Senate, to the British Houses of Commons and Lords, whose powers flow from different sources, are mutual checks on each other, and will thus promote the real happiness and security of the country. A government thus established would harmonize the whole. Elbridge Gerry, a skeptic throughout the convention, and incidentally one of only three delegates who stayed to the end and refused to sign the final constitution, added that the great mercantile interest and of stockholders is not provided for in any mode of election. They will, however, be better represented if the state legislatures choose the second branch. George Mason of Virginia, an inveterate populist, changed his thinking and supported the motion. Mr. Mason then spoke to the general question, observing on the propriety that the second branch of the national legislature should flow from the legislature of each state to prevent encroachments on each other and to harmonize the whole. Rufus King of Massachusetts made his own notes of the early debate about the means by which senators should be chosen. On the motion that there should be a large number of senators to ensure representation in the body of as many of the leading families and interests in the country, King quoted Madison as saying, "The Senate should come from and represent the wealth of the nation, and this being the principle, the proposed amendment cannot be adopted. Besides, the numbers will be too large." History proves this proposition that delegated power has most weight and consequence in the hands of a few. The Roman tribunes, when few, checked the Senate. When numerous, they divided, became weak, and ceased to be the guardians of the people, which was the object of their institution. Pennsylvania's James Wilson also proffered his views on a national legislative body elected by the more numerous, popularly elected House or by the state legislatures. "I well know that all confederations have been destroyed by the growth and ambition of some of their members, and if the state legislatures appoint the senators, the principle will be received by which the ancient confederacies were ruined. I therefore propose that the senators be elected by the people, and for this purpose that the territory be formed into a convenient divisions or districts." Opposition to Wilson's motion was nearly unanimous. Only his own state, Pennsylvania, approved of his plan. The other states voted no. Mason again aptly crystallized the emphatic attitude of the convention in its consideration of the provenance of the Senate. It is true that the old confederacies were ruined by great, overgrown power and the ambition of some of their members, but their circumstances differed from ours. We have agreed that the national government shall have a negative on the acts of the state legislatures. The danger now is that the national legislature will swallow up the legislatures of the states. The protection from the occurrence will be the securing to the state legislatures the choice of the senators of the U.S., so adopted unanimously. After the convention's draft constitution was dispatched to the states for ratification, the character of the Senate was an imperative selling point about the federal nature of the proposed national government. In Federalist 39, Madison went to great pains to delineate the ways in which the Constitution established a federal, republican form of government. The first question that offers itself is whether the general form and aspect of the government be strictly republican. It is evident that no other form would be reconcilable with the genius of the people of America, with the fundamental principles of the Revolution, or with that honorable determination which animates every votary of freedom to rest all our political experiments on the capacity of mankind for self-government. After noting that the people of the country are directly the source of authority for the new federal government, hence the "We the People" start to the preamble to the Constitution, and that the states, as independent sovereigns of governance with their own writs from the people, had to ratify the Constitution before it could take effect, Madison then dissected the proposed government to identify the national and federal aspects of its composition. While the House, elected directly by the people in proportion to the populations of the various states, was a national body, the Senate, on the other hand, will derive its powers from the states as political and co-equal societies, and these will be represented on the principle of equality in the Senate, as they now are in the existing Congress. This circumstance, he contended, was distinctive to a federal government rather than a unitary national entity. The disposition at the state conventions was largely in favor of the Senate serving as an indispensable venue for the representation of state interests at the national level. However, other questions about the operation of the Senate arose. The Massachusetts Ratification Convention saw prolonged and passionate discussion about both the 2-year term for members of the House and the 6-year term for senators. The organization of the Senate was the subject of Federalist Fisher Ames's speech to the Massachusetts Ratification Convention. Ames, a highly regarded figure, said that the Senate, by its unique nature, exemplified the sovereignty of the states, while the House of Representatives was the dominion of the individuals. This meant that the Senate served as a federal feature and a guard against the national government eventually subsuming the states, a recurring complaint among delegates to the Commonwealth's Ratification Convention. Ames even warned that if members of the Senate were elected directly by the people, it would make it much easier for the federal government to consolidate the state governments under its control. State governments, Ames said, spoke for the wishes and feelings and local interests of the people. They were the safeguard and ornament of the Constitution, a shelter against the abuse of power and the natural avengers of our violated rights. He characterized senators as the ambassadors of the states. At the Virginia Ratification Convention, in response to Patrick Henry's concerns about an omnipotent federal government, Madison argued, in part, that the members to the National House of Representatives are to be chosen by the people at large, in proportion to the numbers in the respective districts. When we come to the Senate, its members are elected by the states in their equal and political capacity. But had the government been completely consolidated, the Senate would have been chosen by the people in their individual capacity, in the same manner as the members of the other house. Thus it is of a complicated nature, and this complication, I trust, will be found to exclude the evils of absolute consolidation, as well as of a mere confederacy. If Virginia was separated from all the states, her power and authority would extend to all cases. In like manner, were all powers vested in the general government, it would be a consolidated government. But the powers of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects, beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. The only real question raised during the state ratification conventions was unrelated to the structure of the Senate. Discussions emerged over whether state legislatures could instruct senators how to vote on any given issue. The idea was even raised later in the first Congress, when the House was debating the proposal that would become the First Amendment. A congressman from South Carolina asked why the amendment did not include language providing for the right of citizens to make binding instructions to their representatives in Congress. Madison, a representative from Virginia and the lead author of the proposed amendments, said that it was redundant to do so. Citizens inherently had the right to influence their representatives, and state legislatures had the right to instruct their senators. It would also be impossible, as supporters of the right to instruct had wanted, to institute a penalty for senators who failed to follow explicit instructions, or for states not to be bound by federal legislation for which their edicts were ignored by their senators. This idea died when it was pointed out it would amount to a de facto veto by states of federal laws. Although there were various points of trepidation in every state ratifying convention about some aspect of the Constitution's design, which were aired fully and passionately, none of the amendments to the Constitution suggested by any of the state ratification conventions included the direct popular election of senators. There were unquestionably many people from all stations in life, from every corner of the new country, represented at the state ratifying conventions. Many were fearful that the new federal government would seize state authority and centralize power. The state legislature's role in selecting senators was considered one of the most significant firewalls. There was never serious consideration of the direct popular election of both houses of Congress. The first proposed constitutional amendment to change the way senators were chosen was introduced by Representative Henry R. Storrs from New York in 1826. It went nowhere. Similar amendments were introduced in 1829 and 1855, neither of which was any more successful than the first attempt. In 1868, President Andrew Johnson sent to the Senate a proposed constitutional amendment that included a provision for the popular election of senators, as well as language to change the presidency to a single 6-year term. That proposal went nowhere. The proposal that eventually became the 17th Amendment, providing for the direct popular election of senators, probably would not have become part of the Constitution had it been brought forward in other times. In fact, it failed when it was introduced several times over the decades before it was finally ratified. The idea benefited from the unique political and cultural atmosphere that consumed the nation during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a progressive populism simultaneously promoting radical egalitarianism and centralized authoritarianism. Public sentiment grew amenable to changing the method of selecting senators. State legislatures responded to these pressures by letting the public vote, in some fashion, on who they wanted as their senators. For example, in some states, the legislature would nominate candidates from each party. The state legislature would then take under advisement the public's preference in choosing the senator, effectively letting the public vote in a primary election to select the finalists from whom the legislature would pick the senator. 31 states offered some manner of popular voting on senators at some point before the 17th Amendment was ratified. At the time, among the most persuasive arguments offered for changing the way senators were chosen was that the state legislatures were occasionally in disarray over the selection of senators, unable or unwilling to find enough votes to elect a senator, which occurred during the 19th century. Thus, states were denied full representation in the Senate from time to time. For example, one of Delaware's Senate seats was unoccupied from March 1899 to March 1903. Moreover, the Delaware legislature failed to select any senators from 1901 to 1903. In 1897, in Oregon, one-third of the members of the legislature refused to take their oaths of office to prevent their opponents from electing the next senator. The legislature was in session for 53 days without conducting a single official act, including electing a senator. All told, from 1895 to 1905, state legislatures in California, Delaware, Montana, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Utah, and Washington State failed to elect senators for periods ranging from 10 months to 4 years. Even so, vacancies for lengthy periods were rare. The day after the 17th Amendment became part of the Constitution, the balance of power that had existed between the states and the federal government since the Constitution's ratification was dealt a critical blow. The long silence of the states had begun. The states no longer had a legislative venue, or any venue, to influence directly the course of the federal government. This contributed mightily to the dismantlement of the state's traditional and exclusive areas of governing responsibility. As a result, today, the federal government fills whatever areas of governance and even society it so chooses. State sovereignty exists mostly at the will of the federal government. The federal government's limited nature under the Constitution was transmuted into the kind of centralized power structure the framers worked so diligently to thwart. Yet this proposed amendment, perhaps more than the others, may be considered the most controversial and politically difficult to institute. After all, the direct popular election of senators was sold as, among other things, empowering the people against wealthy, corrupt, and connected special interests. Opponents of the 17th Amendment will undoubtedly be accused of being anti-democracy and favoring politicians choosing politicians. Of course, the statist is the architect of the current post-constitutional environment, in which governing masterminds attack relentlessly the individual's independence and free will. The statist may claim to defend democracy, but in fact, he abandons the electoral process when the outcomes do not advance his agenda. He then resorts to legal and policy evasions and contrivances, relying on government by clandestine lawmaking, judicial overreach, and administrative fiat, all of which destroy self-government. Indeed, the state convention process is a response to an oppressive federal government, the potential of which was feared by the framers. However, it will be opposed by the statist, for he may pose as a Democrat, but it is democratic tyranny that he favors. Moreover, the proposed amendment, along with the others, provides recourse against the kind of centralized and ubiquitous edifice the federal government has become. It is the state legislatures, acting together, that can buffer the individual from the relentless trespasses of the federal government and restore constitutional republicanism. And what of the post-17th Amendment Senate? Rather than spending time conferring with the elected state officials who would have sent them to Washington, D.C., and representing primarily state interests in the Senate, these senators now spend more time with, and are more beholden to, Washington lobbyists, campaign funders, national political consultants, and national advocacy organizations. In fact, states are often viewed as little more than another constituency, one among hundreds, with interests that may or may not be relevant to or comport with a senator's political and policy ambitions. Furthermore, state sovereignty is not a top priority for most senators because the state legislatures hold no sway over them. Thus, situations arise where senators vote for major federal legislation over the strenuous objections of the states. For example, more than half of all states, 27 states, joined federal litigation to overturn the so-called Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare. Yet the law was passed in the Senate by a large majority of 60 votes. In Virginia, both senators, Mark Warner and Jim Webb, voted for Obamacare, despite strong opposition from Virginia state officials. The state attorney general, Ken Cuccinelli, was among the first to bring a lawsuit. Consequently, as a result of one election cycle in 2008, where the Democratic Party controlled all the elected parts of the federal government for a short 2-year period, there was no counterweight or check on lawmaking, which a Senate whose members were elected by the state legislatures would have provided. Although in the very next election cycle in 2010, the Republican Party won historic victories at all levels of government, including a huge victory in the House of Representatives, the Senate and President resisted all efforts to modify or repeal Obamacare. Its implementation proceeded at a feverish, albeit chaotic pace, as it does today. Meanwhile, the people continue to oppose Obamacare, as they have from the outset. The 17th Amendment serves not the public's interest, but the interests of the governing masterminds and their disciples. Its early proponents advanced it not because they championed democracy or the individual, but because they knew it would be one of several important mechanisms for empowering the federal government and unraveling constitutional republicanism. And they have done so, they claim, with the consent of the citizen, for the citizen can cast a vote for his senator. Of course, the federal government's utopian mission is undeterred by voting, should the citizenry vote in opposition to it. The vote is easily and routinely frustrated by all the federal branches, as is self-government generally. The proposed amendment repeals the 17th Amendment, thereby re-establishing the Senate to the character intended originally by the framers and set forth in the Constitution. As such, it returns Congress to a true bicameral institution, provides the states with direct input into federal lawmaking decisions in real time, decentralizes the influences on a senator from Washington, D.C. to the states and local communities, and encourages a more rational, reflective, and collaborative legislating process. In addition, the proposed amendment ensures that no Senate vacancy can continue beyond 90 days, and that state legislatures have the authority to remove a senator for any reason. Chapter 4. An Amendment to Establish Term Limits for Supreme Court Justices. Section 1. No person may serve as Chief Justice or Associate Justice of the Supreme Court for more than a combined total of 12 years. Section 2. Immediately upon ratification of this amendment, Congress will organize the justices of the Supreme Court as equally as possible into 3 classes, with the justices assigned to each class in reverse seniority order, with the most senior justices in the earliest classes. The terms of office for the justices in the first class will expire at the end of the 4th year following the ratification of this amendment. The terms for the justices of the second class will expire at the end of the 8th year and of the third class at the end of the 12th year, so that 1/3 of the justices may be chosen every 4th year. Section 3. When a vacancy occurs in the Supreme Court, the President shall nominate a new justice who, with the approval of a majority of the Senate, shall serve the remainder of the unexpired term. Justices who fill a vacancy for longer than half of an unexpired term may not be renominated to a full term. Section 4. Upon 3/5 vote of the House of Representatives and the Senate, Congress may override a majority opinion rendered by the Supreme Court. Section 5. The congressional override under Section 4 is not subject to a presidential veto and shall not be the subject of litigation or review in any federal or state court. Section 6. Upon 3/5 vote of the several state legislatures, the states may override a majority opinion rendered by the Supreme Court. Section 7. The state's override under Section 6 shall not be the subject of litigation or review in any federal or state court, or oversight or interference by Congress or the President. Section 8. Congressional or state override authority under Sections 4 and 6 must be exercised no later than 24 months from the date of the Supreme Court rendering its majority opinion, after which date Congress and the states are prohibited from exercising the override. The framers of the Constitution anticipated many things. They were concerned about a national executive, the president, becoming a tyrant. So they created a powerful legislature and an independent judiciary to slake presidential ambitions. They worried about the momentary passions of a tempestuous time inflaming the populace, and by extension the Congress. So they created the presidential veto, and divided legislative authority between a House of Representatives selected by the people and a Senate chosen by the state legislatures. Some of the framers also feared a too autonomous judiciary that would grow in power and purview, and eventually swallow the other branches of the federal government and the states. To protect against this, they granted Congress the power to define both the size of the Supreme Court and the makeup of the federal court system below the High Court. And with only a few exceptions, they also granted Congress the power to determine the original and appellate jurisdictions of every federal court. In addition, to ensure that both the executive and judicial branches did not become sinecures for corrupt office holders, they granted Congress the power to impeach and remove judges and most federal officials, up to and including the president in certain cases. Moreover, in order to help control the scope and reach of the central government and safeguard state sovereignty, they enumerated in detail the powers and limitations of federal authority both in the Constitution itself and what would become the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments approved by the first Congress and ratified by the states in 1791. Beyond freedom from undue influence, the framers also realized that the judiciary's independence had to come with some significant strings attached, ensuring it fit into a republican form of government. Federal judges were expected to adjudicate cases and controversies that arose under federal criminal law and civil statutes, and exercise very little authority beyond that narrow scope. Contrary to the opinions of some notable Supreme Court justices and others down through the years, the reason the framers did not specifically grant to the Supreme Court the much broader authority to judge the constitutionality of federal laws is that there was strong sentiment that such a function was well outside the authority of judges. This was a primary reason Congress was granted authority to structure the courts. In particular, on June 4, 1787, at the Constitutional Convention, the delegates took up the issue of granting the national executive, the title of president had not yet been adopted, the ability to give a negative veto to any act of the national legislature. Some delegates, including James Madison, initially favored a council of revision made up of the executive and judiciary, which could reject acts of the legislature. The convention quickly rejected the idea of including the judiciary in such a review process. They did not want judges involved in the legislative process, thereby reviewing laws they would eventually have to adjudicate. Instead, the delegates came up with the presidential veto. Subsequent debate centered on the size of the majorities in the branches of the legislature necessary to override a veto, and whether or not to even include the possibility of the legislature overriding a veto at all. Alexander Hamilton, a prominent delegate from New York and advocate of a powerful central government, thought the executive should be given an absolute negative over legislative acts. Pennsylvania's James Wilson observed that the mere presence of an executive veto would cause it to be seldom used, even with a legislative override option. The legislature would know that such a power existed and would refrain from such laws as it would be sure to defeat. The veto's silent operation would therefore preserve harmony and prevent mischief. The point is that the framers clearly intended to create intrinsic limitations on the ability of any one branch or level of government to have unanswered authority over the other. Moreover, there can be no doubt that were the conditions that exist today, with the Supreme Court involving itself in minute and endless facets of everyday life, known to the convention delegates, they would undoubtedly endorse a check on judicial authority. In Federalist 78, Hamilton wrote, in part, "Whoever attentively considers the different departments of power must perceive that in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution, because it will be least in a capacity to annoy or injure them. The executive not only dispenses the honors, but holds the sword of the community. The legislature not only commands the purse, but prescribes the rules by which the duties and rights of every citizen are to be regulated. The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of the society, and can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm even for the efficacy of its judgments. This simple view of the matter suggests several important consequences. It proves, incontestably, that the judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power, that it can never attack with success either of the other two, and that all possible care is requisite to enable it to defend itself against their attacks. It equally proves that though individual oppression may now and then proceed from the courts of justice, the general liberty of the people can never be endangered from that quarter. I mean so long as the judiciary remains truly distinct from both the legislature and the executive." In Anti-Federalist 11, Brutus, believed to be New York judge and Anti-Federalist Robert Yates, one of the most articulate opponents of the Constitution, was alarmed. He warned, "The real effect of this system of government will therefore be brought home to the feelings of the people through the medium of the judicial power. It is, moreover, of great importance to examine with care the nature and extent of the judicial power, because those who are to be vested with it are to be placed in a situation altogether unprecedented in a free country. They are to be rendered totally independent, both of the people and the legislature. No errors they may commit can be corrected by any power above them, if any such power there be, nor can they be removed from office for making ever so many erroneous adjudications." In addition, Yates made this prediction in Anti-Federalist 15. "Perhaps nothing could have been better conceived to facilitate the abolition of the state governments than the constitution of the judicial. They will be able to extend the limits of the general government gradually and by insensible degrees, and to accommodate themselves to the temper of the people. Their decisions on the meaning of the Constitution will commonly take place in cases which arise between individuals, with which the public will not be generally acquainted. One adjudication will form a precedent to the next, and this to a following one. Yeats, who died in 1801, did not live to see the 1803 Supreme Court decision in Marbury v. Madison. No doubt he would have been appalled. In his decision, Chief Justice John Marshall wrote, in part, "The judicial power of the United States is extended to all cases arising under the Constitution." Could it be the intention of those who gave this power to say that in using it, the Constitution should not be looked into? That a case arising under the Constitution should be decided without examining the instrument under which it arises? This is too extravagant to be maintained. It is true, Marshall wrote that the judiciary should exercise judicial review prudently. However, this was of little consolation. By claiming authority not specifically granted by the Constitution, abuses of power would certainly follow, as they have. Although the decision has been lauded by many scholars of all philosophical stripes, the fact is that the ruling altered and expanded the court's limited authority to adjudicate civil disputes and criminal complaints into a judicial oligarchy with few institutional limits on its power. And the extent to which there are limits depends on the forbearance of the very courts that snatched the authority in the first place. It would seem that if a Supreme Court majority of 5 lawyers has the final word on constitutional matters, then governance comes down to selecting 5 lawyers. This is obviously contrary to the framers' intent. Had the Constitutional Convention conferred such authority on a handful of individuals, which it most assuredly did not, it is indeed doubtful it would have conferred life terms upon them and provided no recourse whatever. No less than Thomas Jefferson, the original author of the Declaration of Independence, was furious about the Marbury decision. In a letter to Abigail Adams, John Adams's wife, Jefferson wrote, a year after Marbury was issued, "The Constitution meant that its coordinate branches should be checks on each other. But the opinion which gives to the judges the right to decide what laws are constitutional and what not only for themselves in their own sphere of action, but for the legislature and executive also in their spheres, would make the judiciary a despotic branch." Jefferson's concerns with judicial power became more pronounced as he passed into old age. In 1820, he wrote to William Jarvis, "To consider judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions is a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Our judges are as honest as other men, and not more so. They have with others the same passions for party, for power, and the privilege of their corps, and their power the more dangerous, as they are in office for life and not responsible, as the other functionaries are, to the elective control. The Constitution has erected no such single tribunal, knowing that to whatever hands confided, with the corruptions of time and party, its members would become despots. It has more wisely made all the departments co-equal and co-sovereign within themselves." Decades later, President Abraham Lincoln would have to grapple with the Supreme Court's 1856 decision in the notorious Dred Scott v. Sanford case, which was an abomination. The issues included whether Scott, a slave, could sue for his freedom based as a longtime resident of a free territory, the territories of the Louisiana Purchase, and whether Congress's ban of slavery in those territories was constitutional. Chief Justice Roger Taney, who held that office from 1836 until his death in 1864, argued for the majority of the court's members that Scott was not a citizen, for citizenship had been confined to the white race, and therefore Scott had no standing to sue. Moreover, he declared that Congress did not have constitutional authority to ban slavery in those territories, for it denied slaveholders property without due process. Should Taney and the court have had the final word? The Dred Scott decision was a major impetus for the Civil War. On March 4, 1861, during his first inauguration speech, Lincoln said, "I do not forget the position assumed by some that constitutional questions are to be decided by the Supreme Court, nor do I deny that such decisions must be binding in any case upon the parties to a suit as to the object of that suit, while they are also entitled to very high respect and consideration in all parallel cases by all other departments of the government. And while it is obviously possible that such decision may be erroneous in any given case, still the evil effect following it, being limited to that particular case, with the chance that it may be overruled and never become a precedent for other cases, can better be borne than could the evils of a different practice. At the same time, the candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by decisions of the Supreme Court, the instant they are made in ordinary litigation between parties in personal actions, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers, having to that extent practically resigned their government into the hands of that eminent tribunal. Nor is there, in this view, any assault upon the court or the judges. It is a duty from which they may not shrink to decide cases properly brought before them, and it is no fault of theirs if others seek to turn their decisions to political purposes." Less than 50 years later, Woodrow Wilson, a leader of the progressive movement, who served as the 28th president from 1913 to 1921, would take the opposite view. In fact, he endorsed flat-out judicial tyranny. In 1908, Wilson argued, "The character of the process of constitutional adaptation depends first of all upon the wise or unwise choice of statesmen, but ultimately and chiefly upon the option and purpose of the courts. The chief instrumentality by which the law of the Constitution has been extended to cover the facts of national development has, of course, been judicial interpretations, the decisions of the courts. The process of formal amendment of the Constitution was made so difficult by the provisions of the Constitution itself that it has seldom been feasible to use it. And the difficulty of formal amendment has undoubtedly made the courts more liberal, not to say more lax, in their interpretation than they would otherwise have been. The whole business of adaptation has been theirs, and they have undertaken it with open minds, sometimes even with boldness and a touch of audacity." It is worth noting that Lincoln, who insisted on judicial limits, led the effort to abolish slavery. Contrarily, Wilson, who demanded an all-powerful court, enthusiastically supported segregation. Hence, in Wilson's view, the federal judiciary was to behave as a perpetual constitutional convention, without the benefit of representation and input from the states, rewriting the Constitution as a relative handful of judges divine the merits of this or that issue, nearly always promoting the centralization and concentration of power in the federal government. Of course, the constitutional structure and amendment processes are thereby eviscerated. Yet this view has gained common acceptance and widespread adherence in legal and political circles, and the behavior is self-perpetuating, for no effective systemic mechanism has been initiated to curb or halt its imprint on the Constitution. Indeed, a movement is and has been afoot in academia and in the courts to institutionalize within the Constitution, via the judiciary, social and economic agendas that should be left to the body politic. For example, Georgetown University law professor Robin West argues that we need a progressive jurisprudence, a jurisprudence that embraces rather than resists and then reinterprets our liberal commitment to the rule of law, the content of our individual rights, and the dream of formal equality. More inclusive interpretations, more generous reimaginings, could then undergird, and in a principled way, particular constitutional arguments. Rather than relentlessly buck, deconstruct, and vilify the seeming naturalness of legal arguments based on moral premises, we ought to be providing such premises and natural and general arguments of our own. But first, we need to reimagine. Similarly, Yale law professor Bruce Ackerman has campaigned to interpret the Constitution's 14th Amendment to implement the so-called Second Bill of Rights, in which President Franklin Roosevelt declared that the federal government should ensure the right to a useful and remunerative job in industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation, to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, of every businessman large and small to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home and abroad, of every family to a decent home, to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, to a good education. Ackerman said his aim is to redeem the lost promise of the 14th Amendment's vision of national citizenship through the enactment of framework statutes and the judicial development of the meaning of privileges and immunities of American citizenship. For Georgetown University law professor Lewis Michael Seidman, the answer to the further centralization of government is not to waste time with deceptive and deceitful interpretations of constitutional provisions by his fellow law professors, as acceptable as that might be to those who seek the fundamental transformation of America, but to abandon the Constitution outright. He states plainly what others in academia and the legal profession have promoted less forthrightly. Seidman argues, as the nation teeters at the edge of fiscal chaos, observers are reaching the conclusion that the American system of government is broken. But almost no one blames the culprit. Our insistence on obedience to the Constitution, with all its archaic, idiosyncratic, and downright evil provisions. If we acknowledged what should be obvious, that much constitutional language is broad enough to encompass an almost infinitely wide range of positions, we might have a very different attitude about the obligation to obey. It would become apparent that people who disagree with us about the Constitution are not violating a sacred text or our core commitments. Instead, we are all invoking a common vocabulary to express aspirations that, at the broadest level, everyone can embrace. It would seem that numerous Supreme Court justices are in essential agreement with Seidman's disdain for the Constitution. Too often, they look for ways to elude the Constitution's limits in order to impose their own personal policy preferences on the parties before them and society generally. One such method has been an increasing reliance on international